This is The Strategy Inside Everything.
I'm Caitlin Maude Moon.
Hi, y'all. I'm back. Adam has been working on some other projects, which he cannot wait to tell you all about soon. But in the meantime, I am so excited to be guest hosting The Strategy Inside Everything. My name is Caitlin Maude Moon. And today on the podcast, we have two of my dearest friends from Boston joining us. We have Ezra Engelbart and Matt Raynone, who work at CVS Health. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you so much for having us.
Of course. Ezra, do you want to kick us off and tell us a little bit about your background and how you came into the role that you're in now?
Sure. I'm currently a creative strategy director at CVS Health in our in-house agency, which is called Heart House. I've been here about 2.5 years. I started kind of early days of the pandemic in May of 2020. My background is all brand planning, brand strategy across traditional agencies, digital agencies, and then over the last 5 years, in-house agencies. So I've worked at pretty much all the big ones in Boston and then in-house most recently at iBrands, the Better For You Beverage Company, and then Wayfair, and then now CVS.
Hi, I'm Matt Raynone. I'm also a creative strategy director at CVS Health in Heart House. I have a very different career. I've really only been at two companies over the last 15 years. I'm going on my 10th year at CVS Health in a couple different roles. Currently, creative strategy director within the in-house team. Prior to that, I was doing marketing strategy on some of the loyalty and digital products. And then prior to that, I was in a little bit more of an account role for the in-house team. Before I came to CVS, I was at AMP Agency in Boston for 7 years, and I was in a couple different roles there too. And starting out in account, moving to new business and strategy. And then right before I left, was doing a little bit of 50-50 split between new business and corporate communications for the agency. So I've been in a lot of different roles, but just not at a lot of different places. So thank you so much for having us on.
This should be fun. Well, you both come from agency backgrounds, but I know, Ezra, you spent the longest and like might have the most diverse background at different agencies in Boston. Would you be able to tell us a little bit about what the difference has been between planning side roles at agencies and planning on the client side?
Yeah, I think so I've worked at Arnold, Digitas, Sapient Nitro, Mullen, all in the Boston area. And then in-house at By, Wayfair, and now CVS. I think the biggest difference that I've seen is that in-house, most people don't have a clue what a planner is, especially planner strategists. I'm going to use those terms interchangeably. They don't really have a clue what the job is. Even if they have an in-house creative department, let's say, they may not know what it is. If they have a true in-house agency, and we can talk a little bit about how I define that in a minute, but then the people within the agency, some of them, the people who hire me perhaps, might know what it is. But the average in-house creative, in-house marketers, all those people, they tend not to really get what the job is. And even, which is shocking, because even people who work with external agencies also, and they work with planners at those external agencies, like somehow their brain disconnects when it comes to the in-house team, that they don't get why I'm there. So that's the biggest change, is that in all three of my roles, I've been, well, my first two in-house roles, I was the only / head of planning. And now there's two of us, there's Matt and I. But, you know, for the most part, the job has been like, do all the planning work, educate everyone on what planning is, and evangelize for more planning all at the same time. I think that's probably what I would say the biggest difference is. And the other thing, too, is that at the external agency, planners tend to wear a lot of hats. They are like the research person, the insights person, the brand, the creative testing person. They are the one who's supposed to know about all the interesting things happening in the world. Like all those different things. That's like 8 different jobs when you go client side. And so I think there is a lot of trying to define, as I said, like trying to define who you are, what you're doing there is like, but don't we have someone doing that? And we have someone else doing that. And we have someone else doing that. And someone else doing that. And so I think for a lot of times it's like, it's hard to define the planner role because clients have so many more resources than agencies do.
Yeah.
Matt, what do you think?
Yeah. How do you deal with that, Matt? what's the solution?
Well, yeah. So there's two things. And I want to echo one point that Ezra just mentioned about all of the resources on hand in-house is there is so much research and so much knowledge and so much data. What I think we end up doing a lot of times is trying to like sort through all of it and try to make sense of it. So I think like that's really where we bring probably the most value to our partners in-house is taking all the stuff that everybody has in their heads or elsewhere and finding it and then just making sense of it and saying, I think we can actually simplify this quite a bit. When yes, we have 50 very disparate data points, but what that's really all pointing to is this. And I think that's where a lot of times our partners will come to us and say, can I just run something by you? I'm thinking this. Let me just play it out in my head and then we can talk about it. And a lot of times what we end up playing is this almost like simplification role so that we're not over strategizing because we have swaths and swaths of data that we're trying to get through. So there's the first point. And then I think the second point, yeah, like there, I would say about 10% of our role is continuing to educate what we do and what value we offer. So what we end up doing is just getting our hands in a lot of stuff to try to continue to prove, like, I think if you ask most people, they would say like, I don't always remember what they do, but every time I work with them, I really appreciate the work that they're doing for us.
Which is both good and bad for your career progression.
Exactly. Right?
If people don't know what you do, it gets hard to know when to involve you. But it also can be hard to evaluate you because it's like, well, I don't know, they did a good job, but what were they supposed to be doing?
So how do you split responsibilities between your in-house agency and external agencies that you all might work with?
It's really project by project. We have a few agencies that are on a bit of a retainer, but there's so many different pieces of our business, not even just between the multiple parts of the CVS Health business around the CVS Health Enterprise, the retail division, the Aetna healthcare business, and then the Caremark pharmacy benefit manager. So there's a lot of work already, but then when you kind of even break that down even more, so Ezra is mostly focused on pharmacy and digital solutions, where I focus mostly on like the front of the store. So more of the retail side of it. Project by project, we kind of evaluate and we have a team that sort of evaluates what is the scope of the project, what's the scope of the campaign. And then they determine, is this going to be something that is led by the Heart House team? Is this something that's going to be led by some of our external partners? Or is this going to be something that's sort of in between where perhaps the external partners are sort of developing the bigger idea? And then our team is executing some of the other channels within it. So I think in times where we have an external partner that's the lead, we're sort of brought along for the ride. We provide some consultation here and there, but we kind of take a little bit of a step back and let their planners do their thing. And then once things are starting to get, you know, cemented together, that's when we'll come in and we'll start to work with our teams to say, okay, how do we translate all of this across the things that we have to build?
To build on that too, though, I think we've seen some really great collaboration with the external agencies. One example for recently is like both us and the planners at Saatchi & Saatchi kind of noticed a need for more refined inputs to briefs and to projects. And so the four of us, the two planners at Saatchi and the two, Matt and I, created a new input briefing document that then, you know, sort of would satisfy all of our needs that we've been, you know, workshopping that around and teaching everybody how to use that. And so it was a really nice kind of internal, external planner to planner collaboration that I think is yielding some better briefs. Already.
Well, I think that's a really good point. What is there anything that you think folks on the agency side need to know to work better with their strategy counterparts internally at client side?
I mean, if they have a strategy counterpart client, right, it's pretty rare. It's still a small in the in-house planner world is still very small. But you know, I mean, I think like recognizing that it's sort of like they're like person on the inside almost. Like most, if you're an in-house planner, you probably came from the agency world. So more than, you know, others in the agency, you're almost certain to understand how they think, how they work, what they need, you know, what's really going on when they hang up from the Zoom, you know, those kinds of things. And so I think like you can be that asset, that like fifth column that supports them behind the lines and things like that. And, you know, I think that's kind of like valuable to them. I think for us on the inside in-house team, you know, getting to work with them keeps us in those conversations, you know, and tries to keep the in-house team elevated to the same level as the external agency. I've sort of liked to try and make it so that when people talk about Heart House, they talk about us in the same breath as Saatchi & Saatchi or Gale or Hawkeye or Adventures or any of these other agencies that we work with. We are one of many in the portfolio of creative resources that CVS Health has at its disposal.
Matt, what would you wish that folks on the agency side knew about how things work on the inside?
Yeah, this is a great one. I think this was one of my biggest eye-opening moments when I came over to the brand side, was just understanding how organizations work, what the planning process looks like, how much data is at their disposal. I think that you know, sometimes in the agency world, we're like, oh, we're going to uncover this like really rich insight, or like we're going to find some data point that no one's ever seen before. And it's virtually impossible. There's so much data that brands have, where I think the outside agencies really play a great role, is like I was saying before, is kind of simplifying. What does all of that mean? So I think like number one, knowing that there are resources that exist that you may not have even understood were there. I think the second part is understanding what does the planning process look like and what are the things that are most important to your marketing partners is extremely important, because one of the great value that agencies offer is bringing proactive, really future forward thinking. But even the best idea presented at the wrong time, right? Like budgets have already been signed off and things are moving forward. The planning process is done. The planning process hasn't started yet. Bringing an idea, even if it's really great, at the wrong time can just fizzle out. So just understanding who owns the dollars, when are those dollars getting approved, and how can you be most proactive around those times that the financial decisions are being made, that will help you even more get your really good ideas in front of people at the right time so that they can advocate for them and get dollars. The worst thing to happen is you have a really good idea, but the planning's already done. And it's like, oh yeah, this is a great idea. I don't know how we're going to get the money. This also seems like a lot of work for me to do to try to sell in another thing to my leaders. So just being a part of that planning process and understanding what the timing looks like is probably the biggest thing that I would recommend for anybody to think about.
Ezra, do you have anything to add to that? What do you wish folks knew?
I think the things that I learned really early on in my career was that for most marketers, the advertising, while it may be 150% of the agency's life and job, it might be only like 25% of the brand team's job. And I remember working on Procter & Gamble brands, and, you know, freaking out because I started my career in account. We weren't getting some approval on some banner ads or something we were making for Crest. And it's like, why aren't they paying more attention? Why aren't they more invested in this? They don't even seem to care. And it's like, oh yeah, because like advertising is like 25% of their job, of which they're managing like six different agencies, of which some are shooting TV commercials and we're trying to make banner ads. So we're like a tiny part of a tiny part of their job. They're also like on the phone with Walmart 10 times a day, and they're flying out to Costco headquarters to pitch some custom pack that only you can only get it there. They're working with research to do upstream product development for products that won't be out for a decade. Like, trying to realize that at most organizations, even though, you know, the ad agency is thinking about the ads all day long, it's only a part of what marketers do, and recognizing that, like, how do you make it easy for them to buy things, you know, just like make their job easier. And I think, but I think most people don't think about all the other things that their clients are actually working on.
before we had planned to have this conversation, actually, let's just like full disclosure, we already had this conversation and then there were some technical difficulties. So this is actually the second time we're recording. I am not the podcast pro that Adam is quite yet, but hoping to get there. One of the things I loved about our last conversation is, Matt, I had mentioned like in your title, it does actually include innovation as well. And so I had asked, like, what does the innovation process look like internally, expecting you to say like, oh, it's really slow going, I have to like sell it so hard. And I was going to ask you to like, give us your tips. How do you sell an innovation? But that is not what you said at all. Can you bring us up to speed on how innovation has kind of taken over in some ways with you?
Yeah. Yeah. And it's funny. I actually remember when you asked me that question, and then I remembered that I just didn't answer it the right, what you wanted. So I will, I'll do two parts.
You didn't answer it the right way because you surprised me. I was like, tell me how you get people to buy into innovation. And you're like, I need them to stop buying into innovation.
You come out with a spit.
Yeah, exactly. So it's kind of a two-part answer. The first is that a few years back, a colleague of mine who actually he runs Heart House, he's the head of Heart House. We had come into CVS and we both kind of realized we're like, there's really no innovation engine that exists here. There were certainly pockets of innovation within different teams, but there was never like a CVS way of doing innovation. A lot of times we bring in the Deloittes and the McKinseys and the IDEOs of the world, and they would kind of come in for 9 months, 18 months, and then leave, and all of that institutional knowledge would leave with them. So we actually built a process and a toolkit for how to do innovation at CVS. And it became sort of like a thing that was on the side of our desk. But since we launched that, probably in about 2018, I continue to get tapped to run design thinking workshops and innovation sessions with people. So I end up doing this a little bit off the side of my desk where someone will say, hey, our group heard that you do some trainings. Can you help us out? And I will always say yes, because I'm an advocate of human-centered design. I think it's a really great headspace for people to be. It's a great way to start projects. And it's a great way to just do the right thing at the right time using the right tools to get to the hopefully the right outcome. So I certainly don't have to do the hard sell on it, because I kind of just do it when people come to me and say, hey, I need some help. So that's the first part. The second part, and this is, I think, how I answered it the first time that we talked about, a lot of times what I will typically ask, the first question that I say when people come to me is, I say, do you have the resources to put against this, to take it from an idea to actually put something into market? Because as I was saying, if you go to any company, if you go to any agency, there is no shortage of ideas. There's no shortage of conference rooms that are plastered with post-its. There's Miro boards and mural boards with ideas. It's just a thing. And I call it, sometimes I call it theatrical innovation, which is, yes, we're doing innovation because we do brainstorms and we did a sprint and we all feel good about it and we're patting ourselves on the back, but then nothing actually happens. So a lot of times what I say is, do you have the resources to take this at least and put it in front of people to get feedback? Because the most disheartening thing is to recruit a big team and tell them, oh, we're going to do this innovation sprint and we're going to come up with the next big idea. And you do all these brainstorms and then just nothing happens. It's like, why would I continue to participate with that if all I'm going to do is get tapped to come up with ideas and then nothing happens? So we've kind of brought, Ezra and I have worked with a couple of internal teams over the last year or so to try to get them over to the next step, not just running brainstorms, but a lot of times what I'll have them do is even do an exercise, which is basically, if you got $100 for 1 week to test the best idea that you came up with, what would that look like? And it actually forces people to start to think about experiments and low fidelity prototypes and ways to get their ideas just from it's an idea on a post-it to something that I can actually get feedback from an end user. So that is one of the things that we try to continue to promote, is making sure that you have the right resources when you're doing innovation, and then also making sure that you take a little bit of a pause to make sure you're solving the right things. We we do some problem finding sessions and some root cause analysis sessions with some partners to make sure that, you know, a lot of times what you end up finding is that we're trying to get customers to do this. And what, when it comes down to it, that it, those types of questions are business problems. And those are very self-serving business problems, as opposed to how can we help people with a problem that they have? Because those things will typically generate much richer ideas that are going to be more accepted by customers.
Ooh, it makes me want to ask so many follow-up questions about like insights. On one hand, one of the things that I love about talking to other people who do the type of work we do is just the wealth of like niche facts and information and like little nuggets of learnings that they have from their work. And on the other hand, I have Ezra's voice in the back of my head from the last time where we talked, where he had said something about like, that's not an insight, and like going on a tear about the things that you get from the team that are like not an insight at all. So,
yeah, it's funny you should mention. I mean, I don't remember exactly what I said, but you know, when we, and this may be like planner anathema, but like when we were redesigning that input document with the Saatchi team, we actually took the word insight out. There's no section. It's like, this is the key insight, because frankly, it like breaks people's brains. They either just put like, she's a busy mom and wants to have it all, right? Or they like try and concoct some ridiculous thing because they're like, it's the word insight just like short circuits them. And so we just replaced it with like, what's the tension? What does she want? But what can't she have? What is she trying to do but struggling? What is seems obvious, but it's not happening, right? Like, what are those kinds of tensions, right? What does she hate about this thing that she has to do all the time? Those areas are where we can tap into things and tap into that emotion and bring reality to our work. And you know, yes, sometimes you come up with a really, really amazing insight, if you will. But oftentimes it's like, you know, you got to go to war with the army you've got. And a lot of times you don't have some super deep insight, but you got to make some ads and you got to make a campaign, you got to do a thing. So by relieving some of the pressure on the marketing team to try and nail this insight, it actually yields better inputs and therefore better outputs.
Yeah. And I feel like I remember you had said something too about like people's relationship with the brand just isn't that deep. Like they, you know, it's more functional than maybe we sometimes give it credit for.
Totally. I mean, you know, CVS is working every day to become this massive player in the healthcare space. We have an insurance company, a PBM, we have pharmacies, we have MinuteClinics, we have health hubs, we have all these places where we're moving into in-home care. Matt, stop me if I say anything, you know, insider trading-ish.
We can edit stuff out if we need to.
You know, we're doing all of these things. We're trying to bring together all these things to really drive better health outcomes for people. And, you know, we sometimes, I think, take for granted that when most people hear the name CVS, they think of a store that sells candy and chips and milk and has a pharmacy in the back where they sometimes have to pick up prescriptions, right? That's like the bulk of the relationship most people have with us. And so when we you know, go so far into talking about healthcare and all these kinds of things, people are like, wait, CVS? Like, they know we sell healthy-ish things and they know that we can have a pharmacy there. But, you know, I think we have to remember that not only do most people still think of us as this sort of corner store, which is, you know, again, something we're working really hard on, but also that most people are not going to drive three blocks down the road and wait at a red light to turn left into a CVS when there's a Walgreens on the right. And that's, I think, the biggest struggle when we talk about a lot of these things. Matt said, you know, is the marketing ask too self-serving? It's like, what's going to make somebody choose CVS over Walgreens when they're almost always located near each other? They have generally very similar offerings, very similar hours. You know, it's a very hard thing to distinguish in the mind of the consumer. What's the difference between these two places?
Yeah. But I think that's also, on the other hand, like the value of a brand. You know, when I talk to people about what it is that I do or why brands are important, there's a whole bunch of sneakers that are functionally very similar. You know, there's a whole bunch of denim out there that's functionally pretty similar. But what are those little things that make a difference? And like,
yeah, those, I mean, but you're talking about style and design and art and consumer preference in that sense. Like,
fair. That's my bias. Like,
you can't like prescribe those attributes to the products and services that a retail pharmacy and you know, walk-in clinic type brand offers. Like,
so how do you solve it then? Like, how do you start to differentiate?
I think it's a combination of innovating around the offering, right? Which is CVS is trying to do with, mm-hmm. you know, by buying a health insurance company, by buying an home care company and things like that. I think there's things we're doing in store design to try and outmaneuver the competition. There's things that, you know, there's things you can do with your store brands, products and things like that, that you can, again, try and out innovate and outmaneuver some of the competition. But I mean, I think at some level, you're never going to create a world in which people will drive past one Walgreens after another to get to a CVS. And if you listen to, I can see Matt already smirking, if you listen to, you know, Byron Sharp and the Ehrenberg Bass Institute and those things, you'll find that that's not really the goal. The goal is not to create people who only ever shop at CVS. The goal is to go from, you know, zero to one and to increase that purchase frequency and the visit frequency and all those things. And that's what really, the penetration is what really grows the business, and not so much like getting the person who goes to CVS every week to try and go twice a week.
Well, yeah, I know Matt is like eager to jump in, but I have to ask something.
No. Go for it.
So
I want to hear it.
I immediately think of the relationship, right? Like, I think, well, what if I trust that like pharmacist, or I trust that person who, you know, I see that same face at the retail when I like check out. Do you all have influence over that? Or is there any way that like that can become a part of the strategy where there is more of like people living the brand, I guess? Like, if there's only two of you and thousands of stores, is something like that even possible or in the consideration?
I mean, there is some work going on now that I can't really talk about that I've been a part of. But it's involving, right? How do we elevate that service experience? And, you know, there's a lot of press around if you're a Chewy customer and your dog dies, they mail you a card or flowers or something, right? Like those kinds of things, right? There's a lot of talk about like, oh, at you know, the Ritz-Carlton, they can spend like $2,000 per guest per visit to solve any problems they have. And how do we, you know, Disney-fy the experience of, you know, our stores? And to your point, it's tough, right? 9,000 stores, you know, if you spent, you know, $100 per store, you're talking about, I don't know, what is that, $90,000? And it's one time. And if you do it, you know,
you could have a whole additional like team of associates.
Right. I mean, and so there's a lot of factors at play. Is it tied to employee, you know, associate happiness, and what drives employee happiness, right? Is it, you know, if you had more money to provide them more hours, would they be happier? If you could hire more people, would it reduce their stress level and therefore they could provide better service? If they were paid differently, would it, you know, there's all sorts of things like that. So we get to touch those in certain ways. We do have a little bit of involvement with some of the store design teams, and we've proposed some test and learn type opportunities and experimentation and things like that to try and drive up store satisfaction, employee satisfaction, but it's not the bulk of the work that Matt and I do, but there've been opportunities where we've touched it.
All right, Matt, hit me. How do you differentiate then? in a sea of sameness? How do you differentiate?
I will tell you, I think it's actually, so I think this becomes like the fundamental question around what is the purpose of advertising? Is the purpose of advertising to say, we have all of these things, come and get them? Sure. Will that work? Maybe. But I think what it basically comes down to is I'm sure I'm not the only person who's ever thought this or said this. This is actually probably a quote from somebody. When you don't have something actually differentiating to say, you have to say it in a way that's slightly differentiated, right? So I think that's where, Is that an Ezra? Is that
no? I didn't. That is good. I say it a lot.
Yeah. So I think a lot of it is it comes down to how do you make your communications different from your competition, so that again, like I think we've seen that like advertising doesn't work by giving you information and then you make this really rational decision to say, well, they have that, so I will go buy that right now. Like it's like a consistent, like you have to keep hitting over and over and over and over something that's going to be memorable. So when Ezra said like you're at a light, it's like, am I taking a left into a CVS parking lot or right into a Walgreens parking lot? There's something that fires in the back of your brain that says I'm going there because that one, it just popped up in my head that that's where I'm going to go. So I think a lot of it actually comes down to the strength of the brand and how the brand comes to life and how you can embed yourself in the back of people's brains so that when they're about to make a purchase decision, 3 months from the time that they saw that ad, there was something that connected and they're like, yep, that's where I'm going to go.
Yeah, I agree. And I would just add to that, I think it was like Dale Carnegie said, you can't talk your way out of a situation you behaved your way into, right? Which I think aligns really nicely with my philosophy that brands are what brands do. And so we can run ads all day long, but if we don't actually find ways to provide more value to people, then they won't build those preferences. And so, you know, you want to build in, you know, to use like a tech industry term, like walled gardens, right? How do you connect things to make 1 + 1 = 3 as long as you stay at CVS, right? And how do you make it so that there are compounding rewards and compounding benefits, both financial and non-financial, to, you know, building that relationship so that we do drive that preference and things like that. And I think it's a lot of, there's a lot of doing to be done.
Yeah. Well, and one of the reasons I was so excited to talk to you both, so aside from the fact that we have a pretty lively group chat that I wanted to bring other folks into, which I think is like common in our industry, probably. I know Ezra's in a couple of group chats. I was really excited to talk to you all because I think of all of my friends and peers in the industry, you have been in some of the most unique positions the last few years during the pandemic, working at a company that really is at the forefront of messaging, of public health, of controversy in some ways with things like vaccines. So I am interested to hear what it's been like for you all, and has the experience changed your perspective on what we do at all?
Yeah, so I think that, yes, we were lucky, unlucky enough. I mean, it's a horrible situation, of course, but we were lucky to be in a place of leadership among rolling out vaccines, among rolling out nationwide testing, things like that, which, you know, as hard as it was because we had all of this influx of work that came in. We had all the things that we had already had planned. And now all of a sudden we have all of this additional work related to the pandemic. It was actually a little bit easier for us because we were actually there and we could say, we are here for you because we are doing these things. It wasn't like, we're here for you and buy our trucks because we are, you know, like it, like we had a natural,
which was a like, thing. Good, like that was a was thing. A remember that?
That was a thing. It was like, yes. When you are ready, we'll be there because yes. We're Cottonelle and we're there to wipe your butts during the pandemic. Like, it was just like, there was like this weird, like onslaught of brands trying to put themselves at the center of that story when they didn't really belong, which again, like, yes, they still had to keep the lights on, I assume. And they needed to keep saying a message, and that was probably the most relevant message they could tell at the time. But anyways, we actually were in the position where we could actually, the stories that we told were directly related. So that actually gave us the opportunity to be a leader during that time.
And yeah, I think for me, one of the most interesting parts of it was like, I've never really worked on a controversial product before. And so, you know, getting to do like the vaccine research and the before the vaccine came out, we had a like monthly vaccine attitude tracker, and the data that came back from that was just wild. I mean, I've never had the phrase "mark of the beast" turn up in an open end survey response once, let alone like 3 to 4 times in a single survey. Yeah, so it was really interesting, and it was just, it was just wild. It was so outside my personal bubble and sphere of relationships, like that, you know, I'll say I don't think I know anyone who didn't get it. I don't think I know anyone who wasn't excited about getting it, you know? Yeah. And so to get hit in the face with that real hard dose of reality, that like there are people who think that not only do they not want this product, they think it's horrible and that it should be banned and that it's satanic. And, you know, it was pretty wild.
Yeah. And I remember when we did the podcast that will never be aired, you had said something that I thought was actually kind of beautiful, because I was leading the conversation toward like, did you feel despair? Like, was this hard to like get off calls at the end of the day and like go back to your normal life? And Ezra, you, who I think you would self-describe as a pessimist, actually had quite an optimistic answer, which was like, I actually feel like I had more empathy for just the diversity of people and like serving all people. And what does that look like?
Yeah. I mean, my natural instinct is like, you know, at the time was like, okay, fine, let's give out the vaccines. Anyone doesn't want them, let's send them to some country who does want them. Because like, you know, you had your chance, you know, you didn't get it. And it's like, you know, I took a very like, you don't want it, fine, you know, take your ball and go home kind of attitude. But obviously that's not the right way to do it. I was privileged enough to be on a call with Vivek Murthy, the Surgeon General, which was pretty cool in and of itself. And his whole thing was about empathy. And he was like, you cannot browbeat people into this. You cannot argue them into this. You cannot data them into this. You have to have an empathetic approach. You have to try and walk in their shoes, and you have to try and understand what is it that is making them react this way to something that may save their life, right? And save the lives of their loved ones, right? They are afraid. They have been fed a steady diet of bad and misinformation. And, you know, and their worldviews are being challenged and, you know, all this kind of stuff. And just trying to understand like what, you know, where are they coming from? Because that's the only way you ever really change people's minds, right? You don't, you know, outside of like a, you know, high school debate club, maybe, you don't ever argue your way to victory. You have to come out from a place of empathy. And so, yeah, it certainly like reminded me that you need to think about what is driving these attitudes. And it is, for the most part, it was fear, and people were scared, and they were looking for answers that can confirm their worldviews, and they were finding them for better or for worse. But I am still a pessimist, generally.
You balance each other out then.
Yes, because I'm the eternal optimist. Although I have to say, pessimism and cynicism, it's certainly something that exists in our industry. Mm-hmm. And I think that having a good balance of cynicism to know that like advertising is certainly not the most important thing in the world. And many times people, like regular people, for the most part, don't care about the things that we are saying. Now that I think that it would be naive to not believe those two things. Now, that being said, you can either look at that and have a very like nihilistic view at our industry and say nothing matters, like who cares? Or you can say, well, okay, if people aren't going to care about the stuff that we're doing, how do we make it interesting enough that maybe they will, or maybe there's something that will stick in their heads because we said it in a way that made them laugh or made them, you know, chuckle, or like it reminded them of something that they were going through. So I think like, you kind of have to have this balance. I think there's like, you know, you see it in the advertising Twitter space and on LinkedIn, it's like, there's this like, oh, like this sucks. Like everything's bad about this industry. And then there's the other side of it, which is like this stuff where you're like, you see some of these case studies that you're like, oh my God, this is like us like giving ourselves like the biggest pat on the back ever. But I think like being able to understand that advertising can both be ridiculous and like over celebratory of itself. And also it can actually help businesses. And I think understanding both sides of those things is important, so that you're not too much into your own stuff, but you're also not just like giving up on everything that we're doing.
One of my phone just buzzed with one of my other advertising friend chat group chats. with a link to the left-handed mango chutney commercial, which if you and your listeners have not seen it, just Google left-handed chutney. It is a fantastic and way too real look at our industry. But, you know, one of the friends on this chat, his father was a longtime ad executive, and he asked, and he also works in advertising now, and he said, you know, well, what, like, why? It's Matt's point about it, is it rewarding work and all? And he said, you know, advertising is part of this world. We all have to consume it a lot of the time. And, you know, if you do your job well, maybe you make some of that time a little bit better.
Yeah. Or in your case, like, to bring it full circle, when there is a global pandemic and you are working at a place that is, you know, on the front line of combating that pandemic and helping people and getting them information, like, all of a sudden that advertising work that we were describing earlier, oh, the banners and the commercials and all that, actually becomes like a vital channel for communication and helping people and making a difference. And I think that,
yeah,
like,
I mean,
you don't know when something like this could actually be.
Fundamentally, our job is to change people's behavior, right? Usually it's get them by one kind of peanut butter versus another, which I don't think you can really argue outside of like a defense of capitalism is a super rewarding endeavor.
Until there's like a listeria outbreak and you need to.
Yeah, I mean, I guess, yeah, but every once in a while you get to work on something that does have some, you know, some broader benefit to humankind, and that some thing where you change a behavior from something that's negative to something that's positive and has a really good outcome. So it's rare, I think, that people in advertising get to do that kind of work outside of, like, you know, pro bono, you know, nonprofit things, or you know, the occasional kind of thing like this. And so, you know, it's certainly, I think, one of the more meaningful things I've ever worked on in my 20-year career.
Yeah. And I mean, I would encourage anyone listening to try and find those opportunities too, when you can. If there is some innovation budget, can you test some sort of social impact initiative? Or if there is some cause that aligns with what you're doing that could be mutually beneficial, to co-brand and use your brand's ad dollars to lift up this partner that complements you in a really interesting way. I have had a lot of success as a strategist finding some of those things, because I think not only do they connect with the end consumer, viewer, audience, whoever that is, but I think it makes the work more meaningful for creative teams and for us to work on day in and day out, when we can find that purpose that isn't like a manufactured start with why, like, I've applied purpose after the fact, but is actually a campaign even that feels somewhat purposeful or feels somewhat optimistic, maybe.
Yeah. But it's got to be rooted in something real. Like, whenever I hear too much, and I'm a believer in brand purpose, even though a lot of data now is showing it's kind of BS, but you know, I still sort of want to believe. But like, there was this SNL skit about Cheetos a few years ago where they're like pitching these ridiculously like heart-wrenching sob stories about whatever, and then at the end it's like hard cut Cheetos. And I think that too many people read Simon Sinek, and too much advertising became that way of like, let's just tell some like gut-wrenching story and then stick our brand on the end. And, you know, Matt was sharing with me and our ECD the other day, this like study about the decline of humor in advertising. I mean, I assume you guys are the same. I still remember some of the funniest ads of my, you know, youth and things like that. There's a reason why, like, you know, people over 30, if you say like, what's up, they know exactly what you're talking about, right? And there's, you know, but we're seeing a massive decline in humor in the advertising world.
Yeah, I think that people know that emotion is really powerful for advertising to make connections with the brand. But I think for whatever reason, people automatically, when they hear emotion, they're like, it's got to be sad. It's got to be like a heart-wrenching tale. And humor is an emotion. Related a bit, like, there's a lot of ways to create emotions without having to be so over dramatic. And when it comes down to it, it's like, guys, we're selling toothpaste. We're selling bite. Like, right. There's like, it doesn't have to, like, you don't have to be so serious about everything all the time.
Right.
And you know, and that humor data comes from Kantar, right? I know that there's a lot of mixed feelings about creative testing and optimization within our industry, but like, they have a lot of good insights as to what can make connections with people and what things perform the best when you're trying to create memory structures with people so that they can always remember your brand when they need it.
Well, we are running up on time. So I first want to thank you both so much for doing this with me again, and sharing your wisdom. I feel like you're in such a unique position, to be like in-house, in an in-house agency, getting to do strategy. I think we have so much to learn from you all. And with some of the work you all have been doing over the past couple of years, I'm just excited for more people to hear about it. Is there anything you want to promote, or where can folks find you online? Matt, you want to go first?
Oh, sure. Well, you can find me on mostly on Twitter. I don't really play around with LinkedIn how much I'm there, but I don't do anything for now.
You're on Twitter while it's still up.
Twitter it is hilarious right now. It is November 14th right now for anybody who's listening. And the last week and a half has been just outrageous on Twitter. So you can find me there at Matt_Raynone. And then I think if there's something to promote, Caitlin, I don't know if you can tell, I'm like kind of rocking a little bit of a mustache right now. I still do Movember every month. It's a really good charity just to take care of a lot of issues around men's health. So feel free to check that out. Donate if you have a couple extra bucks.
I'm Ezra802 on pretty much every platform, including my new Mastodon account, which I still have not figured out, but I have the username. The only thing I would promote, if you haven't done it, get a flu shot. We're looking at last year they talked about a twindemic. Now they're talking about a tridemic of RSV, flu, and COVID coming soon to a town school near you. So get your flu shot. That's it. Preferably at a CVS, but honestly, just get it.
Love you guys. I'll talk.
Strategy Inside Everything is produced by me, Adam Pierno. If you like what you've heard, leave a review wherever you listen to podcasts. Actually, I have no idea if that helps or if it's ever done anybody any good. If you really want to help the show and you like what you've heard, share it with someone else you think will dig it. That's the best way to help the show and keep the conversation growing. If you have an idea, a question, or want to push back, go to thatsnotaninsight.com, where you can send me a message or leave me a voicemail that will be added to future shows. Music for the Strategy Inside Everything is by Saw Square Noise. For more information on me, you can go to adampierno.com to learn about my books, my speaking, and my consulting practice. Thanks for listening.
We're the millennial generation. We're special, one of a kind. It's our turn, our time to shine.
Introducing In the Demo, a new podcast about how stories of groups are created, subverted, and destroyed.
My immediate takeaway from this is like, millennials are a pain in the ass for boomers. I bet you if we went back even 2018, we would find articles where it's millennials blaming boomers for the shortage of affordable housing.
On the first season, experienced strategists and researchers Farah Bostic and Adam Pierno pursue the origins of the millennial myth.
When did that change? Early on, there was this optimism about 100 plus million people that were going to change the world. And now the narrative is, can you believe these damn kids?
How did the generation of hope become the enemy? Where do stories this big come from? And why does it matter?
It's astrology for marketers, and it's about as useful.
We're special, one of a kind. We're the millennial generation.
In the Demo, Season 1. Available now. Wherever you get your podcasts, go to inthedemopodcast.com for behind-the-scenes research and supporting information.